Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about depression and identity. The death of actor, comedian, and philanthropist Robin Williams has us still grieving. Maybe it's the jarring disconnect between eagerly awaiting his next performance and knowing he's gone. Maybe it's the equally jarring disconnect that depression took the life of a man who made so many of us so happy. Tonight, we'll do what many people are doing in the wake of his death, opening up a conversation about depression, what it is and what it isn't. We'll also talk about the issues of identity, human beings versus human doings, and what identity means for everyone from the famous to the not famous at all. Let's meet our guests.
Hi, my name is Bob Lyman, and I am a psychiatric social worker here in Duluth, Minnesota. And I work for an organization called Sand Creek. We're an employee assistance counseling group.
And I am Tom Isbell. I'm a professor of theater here at UMD and was a former actor in New York and Los Angeles for 10 years.
Bob, thanks to social media. That was me rolling
thanks
my
to social
eyes.
Media?
That was me rolling my eyes. A lot of folks are weighing in about Robin Williams' death, and there's a lot of misinformation about there. Let's start with what depression is and what depression isn't.
That's a complicated question because each person is wired very uniquely in terms of their brain chemistry.
But depression isn't just feeling kind of blue.
No, it's the point where people are getting to the point where they are feeling sad and empty, and it's extremities. I mean, it's extreme. There's several different types, but I think the type that we're going to talk about today is what would be described as endogenous, the old endogenous type of depression. It's an actual chemical imbalance that occurs in the brain that sometimes can be genetic or can be brought on by severe trauma, those kinds of things. And the intensity of the emotion is to the point where the person is actually deluded, where they feel that they're no good, that they're horrible, that nobody loves them, and that I call it the Eeyore complex, or, well, I might as well go to bed and not worry about it because nobody loves me. And when in actuality, they have a loving family. They have, well, we look at Robin Williams and how deeply loved he was by so many people and the things that he'd done and the accomplishments that he'd made. Yet in his own psyche, he didn't feel that way at all. He, you know, I don't know how he felt, actually. I can just guess and know that the people I've worked with and the suffering that they went through, you really have to work on the delusions that people feel. And sometimes that takes medication to change that, to change the brain chemistry, to be and realize that things aren't as bad as they look. But when people are suicidal, they're at that brink where they don't believe anybody can help them and there's no way out. And occasionally we get cries for help, but I think the biggest sign I've seen is when someone finally makes the decision to commit suicide, there's actually a relief, and they don't often tell anybody what's going to happen. So it's the preventative nature that we need to look at as those early warning signs of helping people who have depression before it gets to the point where they don't talk to people.
One of the things that I've heard people say is what you just mentioned. He had money, he had fame, everybody loved him. What did he possibly have to be unhappy about? But I guess I wondered, in the things that I saw people saying about him, and he was so wonderful and he made me laugh and he was such a great actor, it just seemed like it was all things that he did for them. Very few people knew him well enough to say he was a great person just as he was. I mean, would he have been that loved if he hadn't been a performer? And to wonder what effect that might have had on him.
External factors don't promote happiness. Happiness has to come from within. And that he wasn't happy inside of himself, obviously, if he was going to commit suicide. We don't know why. I heard some say that he was looking at the prospect of a long-term medical illness called Parkinson's, that may have driven him to this point. I don't know. But there are all kinds of things that drive people to this point.
One of the factors that I have observed about depression as opposed to the blues is the component of despair.
Oh, deep, dark despair. Not only the despair, but the anxiety sometimes comes with it. They have intense anxiety and intense despair to the point where the hopelessness is the whole thing. The hopelessness that no one can get them out of the situation that they're in. To come out of that takes an immense amount of courage and determination and support and help.
It's a little known trick that your depressed brain can play on you. You can start with something like a parking ticket or a missed appointment or a snub from a coworker, and you can get in one or two jumps to the conclusion that you'd be better off dead. And it's difficult when it's your brain that's messing with your thought processes.
The serotonin levels in your brain aren't up to a level where the message gets put across the synaptic nerve correctly. And so you get a negative message. Trying to help someone develop that kind of awareness is extremely difficult. Talk therapy is good. Don't get me wrong, you can progress, but there are multitudes of other things I've heard where if people are in formal programs where they're in social groups, where they exercise, where they eat together, where there's camaraderie, all of a sudden you find a difference in their mood. They're in the same situation. They feel that they're not alone. So it's the camaraderie, the exercise, the eating the right diet, the schedule, feeling a cohesiveness with the same type of problem. That's why so many people are put into groups who are depressed, so that they have an understanding that they're not alone, that other people feel the same way. When someone's starting to feel better who has been in that hopelessness and they're coming out of it, they're the kind of people that are great to help pull other people out of that.
Robin Williams had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and I've learned since then that depression can actually be a component of the disease itself. It seems to me like depression would be an appropriate response to things like that.
I think they're in shock when they first hear that. I think there's, you know, the grieving process that Kubler-Ross talks about, of shock and denial first, and then there's a realization and a deep sadness that comes with that. I think of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. He said, you know, there's a group of people that are in a prison camp, and he's been there for a year, and they come and they spend 3 months, and they're dead. Failure to thrive. Or there's another group that, when they're finally liberated, they become mentally ill. Yet there's a third group that somehow maintained their attitude. They had a resiliency that is unbelievable. Is it nature or is it nurture? And I think it's a combination. That I think some of us are more prone to a sadder view of things. But there are people out there that also are very much prone to that. And whatever we can do to help them to walk through that struggle, we need to do it.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about depression and identity this evening, and our guests in the studio, Bob Lyman, a psychiatric social worker and employee assistance counselor, and Tom Isbell, a professor of theater here at UMD and a former professional actor in New York and L.A. Tom, to set the stage, if you'll pardon the metaphor, can you talk a little bit about your own career in New York and Hollywood, because you had the pleasure to work with some very big, very familiar names.
I did, but certainly not on any kind of level of Robin Williams.
Bancroft,
yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, no doubt. And getting to work with a lot of really wonderful people, and Ed Harris and Robert De Niro, I mean, those were pretty life-changing experiences for me. I came out of graduate school and was fortunate to get on a TV series right away, and was fortunate actually that it didn't last very long, so I was able to pay some bills and then, you know, audition for other things. And I did a combination of theater, was in New York at first, and was found that I was getting cast more often in Los Angeles, primarily TV and small roles in film. And so I moved to Los Angeles and did another 7 years of guest stars and TV pilots and TV movies and that kind of thing. And after 10 years, I'd had enough.
So talk a little bit about your own experience with fame, both in terms of the success of your own career and also how you observed it being played out with some of the big name actors and directors that you worked with.
It's interesting because I know when it first happened, I remember that when the first TV movie I was in aired and I had a nice role in it. And I just assumed, well, okay, here it goes. I'm going to be stopped on the street. And no one cared who I was. I mean, there's the other element of being an actor in terms of you create this persona of the character, whatever that character is. You also create this public persona, which I would imagine is not always the same as your actual persona. And that's how you get work. And so I think you're kind of always playing tricks on your mind. My own sense of dealing with the people who were famous and did have careers that for those who it happened abruptly for, I saw them struggle a lot more. For those who had put in the time and trained as actors and were working their way up, they seemed to kind of figure out, okay, this is how it works. And they were pretty grounded. I mean, almost without exception, they seemed really grounded. And the ones who seemed to have more difficulty were the ones who were all of a sudden kind of thrust in this limelight and not really ready for it.
Obviously, we can't and will not presume to know what was going on and what was going through Robin Williams' mind before he made the decision to end his life. But with regard to identity, what are some of the ways that being famous, air quotes, can shape a person's sense of identity, and what can that come to mean to them?
Certainly every person is different and has their own experience with that. I think it's interesting that, you know, some people associate you with certain roles. For example, you know, so Jeff Daniels is coming to play guitar at Big Top, right? And one of the things he has to deal with is his persona of being so famous in Dumb and Dumber. Right. Well, you know, and you read this a lot about writers and artists, and the public kind of is attached to that earlier work, and they want to keep moving. As an actor or any kind of artist, that can be really frustrating.
When we were talking about this a little earlier, you said that you went through some of those same feelings about loss and questioning your identity when you decided to give up acting professionally. And I would imagine your situation would be a little different because that's a choice that you made. It wasn't a choice that was thrust on you. But what was that like?
That was a difficult transition. When I came here, which was, in retrospect, the greatest decision I made. I mean, you know, teaching was a much more appropriate calling for me than being a professional actor, which really, you know, did not suit my personality, that instability of the career. But having said that, I missed performing. I mean, you know, you get into that because there is some kind of exhibitionist quality in you. You want applause. You want laughter. You want to be seen. You want to be in the spotlight, whatever the metaphor. You want that. And then to come and all of a sudden you're teaching. And, you know, as a teacher, what you should be doing is putting that spotlight on them. I mean, rightly so. And all of a sudden I didn't have a place. I didn't have that outlet. And, you know, I would act a little bit here and there at first, but I missed it. And the other thing that I missed and is, you know, someone once said that I worked with that actors are action junkies. We have a low attention span. We have to do this role. We get tired if the run is longer than a month or two because we want to do another project and then another project. And teaching is the marathon. It's not a series of sprints. And so I think that was an adjustment as well. I mean, I can only, you know, speculate what was going on in Robin Williams' mind in terms of his career. I have no idea where he was at with his career. And we can guess, and, you know, I guess it doesn't do us any good. But, you know, you want to keep doing Dead Poets Society and Aladdin and get being that level. And you never want to slip below whatever level you've achieved.
And he may have thought that as the Parkinson's disease progressed, that he wouldn't be able to do that any longer.
Absolutely.
What was the name of the film he was in where his wife had died? She'd committed suicide and he had to go get her out of hell?
What Dreams May Come?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes. That I watched over again and I thought, how interesting.
Mm.
You know, and then they did a another replay where he walked off with a pretend child at his side at the Emmys. They did that in the end. He was so much the energy of a child. You know, he was full of youth in terms of those kinds of things that were part of his personality that I loved. You know, and he was able to ad lib unbelievably well. He was just amazing at that. And I think he really enjoyed those kinds of things. But the piece you were talking about, Tom, is there's something underneath that you get out of that in terms of self-esteem, that we've got to find some balance.
Right.
When you stopped acting and went into teaching, there was a change. And then as you made that transition, there's a fellow, William Bridges, that wrote a book, Transitions, and the transitions from acting to teaching must have been tremendous, you know? So, you know, whenever you do transitions, if you're not prepared for those, and Robin was probably going into a transition of trying to accept Parkinson's disease, maybe.
Right.
You know, we can make assumptions here, but that was more than he could have on his plate. And so, you know, as much as we think everybody loved him, he had a hard time reaching out to be genuine to people who could support him. That was a sad part of it for me, is that, you know, there was no one that really knew him well that could reach out and provide support for him. And he had a hard time asking for help.
Tom, did you find in your experience with some of the big names that you worked with that they had to maintain a distance from people because the people who were surrounding them were either yes men and were so awed by them that they'd say, you know, yes, whatever, or in order to keep people at arm's length from getting into their lives and getting into their privacy?
Yes, no question. I mean, you go on a TV or movie set, and if that person's recognizable at all, they do keep you at arm's length. And at first, it was somewhat disconcerting with some people. But then I realized, you know, the more I went through this process and the years passed, that they had to do it just for self-protection because they would be inundated by hundreds, thousands of people, you know, and they just had to do it. And I can only imagine how difficult that must be in terms of finding comrades. You know, and it's why I think you see that celebrities date celebrities, because they get it. You know, so yeah, I saw that a great deal. And then you see the ones who kind of take that risk and go, you know, to take the barrier down. Like I did a film with Ed Harris, and, you know, I was on set with him for a couple of weeks, and he brought a baseball glove. And every time we had a break, he brought two gloves, and we would go out and play catch, you know. And I will never forget that, you know, because there was someone who's saying, okay, we're gonna do this for a couple of weeks. And, you know, he didn't know me from Adam before, and that was a great experience.
But again, it sounds like choice has a lot to do with this, to choose to interact
right.
with a young actor you don't know and
right.
play catch with him, or to choose to change careers. You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about depression and identity this evening. Our guest in the studio, Bob Lyman, a psychiatric social worker and employee assistance counselor, and Tom Isbell, a professor of theater here at UMD and former professional actor in New York and LA. Bob, do you think that possibly, again, we cannot know and will not be so disrespectful as to say that we do know, but possibly, as we kind of touched on before, that Robin Williams might have felt that if I can't be Robin Williams, big letters, because of the Parkinson's, that I'm not worth anything.
I don't have a guess on that. Knowing what I know of the man, I don't think that would be him at all. I don't think that...
He did seem to find a lot of identity in a lot of the charitable work and the philanthropic work that
right,
he did.
Right. So to honor the man, I think you've got to look at we all, you know, look at somebody and understand that people all are suffering. But we also have to look at what he gave to us. There's some really precious things that he gave as far as sensitivity to a man is losing his children in Mrs. Doubtfire and going back to save your wife from hell. I mean, it's just an amazing amount of versatility as an actor, and some of that is who he was, that kind of person in him. And I think that if we look at the core of anyone, we find kindness and compassion. It's that the suffering that we have around us that we see or misperceive that causes us to do the things that are harmful to other people and ourselves, that misperception.
If we look at actors like some of the actors that Tom was talking about, or I think specifically in terms of sports heroes whose careers are very finite, and it seems like nobody says to them, honey, when you're 30, you can't play football anymore, or you're going to reach a point where you can't do this anymore. And it seems like nobody talks to them or prepares them, because of course everybody around them perhaps is making money, for what are you going to do when your identity needs to change? Do you think that there's a place or a need for society, therapists, friends, family to be encouraging people in that direction, to think about how they'll manage the change of identity when it needs to come?
Well, it's interesting because I deal with young actors, young, very talented actors, and we talk a lot. We have a very realistic program, I think. We talk in all 4 years of their training here very realistically in a straightforward manner about these are the statistics. You know, 5% of all professional actors are not making a living income, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they hear it, but they don't hear it. So, I don't know that with athletes that any amount of telling them is going to really sink in because they want to do it. And rightly so. I mean, that's what we need is people who do want to do it.
I heard, I don't know what radio station it was on, said 1 in 100, 1% of those that are in, let's say, college football or other professional, want to go into professional sports, only 1 out of 100 make it into professional sports. Mm. So that's a huge, you know, that's something they must have to face. But once they get in, the realization, what a denial that I'm going to be young forever. I think of the Green Bay quarterback, Brett
Favre.
You know, he couldn't quit, had to come back.
But I don't think anybody, it's possible that nobody ever talked with him and said, Brett, what are you going to do when you can't play football anymore?
Well, and as we age, we also are in denial that we won't be able to do certain things, and we have to come to that realization that we can't lift the 100-pound.
We start planning single-story houses.
There you go. On one level, including our laundry.
You bet.
And I think to come to that realization and to plan for it is important, because we'll meet and we'll have to face some very major transitions in our lives. And that's a constant. And where are we headed? What's the number one thing that we fear the most? Our death. And when someone dies, like Robin Williams or other people around us, it wakes us up and makes us mindful to the fact that we're not permanent, that we are going to die someday, and that we need to enjoy the present, where we are right now. That one Zen koan in Kung Fu Panda, where the turtle says to the to the panda bear, the past is history, the future is a mystery, today is the present. That's why we call it a gift. And I thought, that's very true. And we need to gift ourselves daily and change that attitude. The whole discourse in society today that is looking at the technique of mindfulness and meditation is part of a journey I think we're taking into our mind to help that very thing that you're talking about, of accepting the fact that we're not going to be able to do all these things in our future lives, that there's an acceptance of that and a realization, and to be comfortable with it rather than to worry about it. It takes an enormous amount of practice to get to that point.
Bob, before we run out of time, one of the things that people who suffer from depression is that we need to keep it a secret for a lot of reasons. There is a stigma attached, in many instances, to mental illness. People who don't understand depression and make comments about it, those comments can just be devastating. And we also don't want people to start to treat us differently, you know, and sort of treat us, look at us warily, like, are you going to crack up at any moment? So if you are keeping your own depression from yourself, or if you know someone and they're keeping their depression a secret, how can you, as a person who may be trying to delude yourself, but how can family and friends, are there signs that they can see to try to intervene before the depression kills the person that they love, or you kill yourself?
One of the best organizations, I think, that help families that are dealing with that is the National Alliance for Mental Illness. They have the family-to-family groups. Families come and learn just exactly that. How do you provide that kind of support? Each one of us are unique in our own ways, and they give something special to this whole universe that is very, very precious. Each life is extremely precious. That if you believe in the concept that we're all in this together, we're all interconnected, and that if you're suffering, I'm suffering too. That's my belief.
There is a NAMI chapter in the Northland. There are a couple of good crisis lines that are available. We'll try to get those numbers and that information up on the website. And another thing that's offered in this community that is not offered in many communities is the Adult Partial Hospitalization Program, which is a kind of a halfway, it's an outpatient program. It's kind of halfway between the locked ward, where you're a danger to yourself or someone else, and seeing a therapist, you know, even once a week.
And the nice part of that partial hospitalization program is you have access to a psychiatrist, so if you need your medications changed or tweaked, they can do that too. And you've got that structure I talked about earlier, and it's very helpful. I think that's a good point. The partial program is good. The group programs that are available through some of the mental health clinics here are also excellent sources. There's a ton of individual therapists that are around that can help people with working on their depression. So,
and there are a lot of options for people in every income bracket and with insurance and without insurance, so the finances don't need to be a barrier to getting that help.
Lake Superior Community Health Center, you know, that's, they've been very good about providing services for people when they don't have insurance. And it's nice with Obamacare on board that people, more people are getting care so that they can go in and take care of a problem like this.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Bob Lyman, a psychiatric social worker and employee assistance counselor, and Tom Isbell, a professor of theater here at UMD and former professional actor in New York and L.A. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson with help from Chris Harwood and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.